So before we get into the detail, really just wanted to confirm the agenda and some of the key learning points from joining this webinar this morning. First of all, we hope you'll learn why HR is needed in a small business and how HR adds value, how your requirements as a small business will evolve as you grow and change, how looking after your team will result in better performance and productivity, and then we'll take a delve into new employment law coming into force during 2020. I'm sure you'll have lots of questions as we go through the webinar. As it said on the first page, if we could ask you to type those into the chat option on the Zoom webinar function, that would be great. They'll then come through to us in real time. We're keeping everybody on mute because we're conscious not everyone can be in a quiet background, so it just helps with making this a productive and useful experience for everyone. So any questions, please type them into the chat facility. So I'm now going to hand over to Mark, who's going to start and dispel some of the common myths about HR. Morning, Mark.
Morning. Thank you, Adam. So actually, people say that HR is over-bureaucratic. HR love a process and will stick to it, whatever the situation, and you need to deal with things quickly and move on. That may be the case, but actually HR can be as simple or as bureaucratic as you want to make it. For small businesses, we personally advocate a straightforward HR approach that can be understood by all. By setting out standards early on, you have a reference point when dealing with issues. Another myth is HR is a blocker. So if you involve HR, it will only lead to delays and we won't get the outcome that we need. Not necessarily, because actually involving HR at the earliest opportunity will ensure that you make the right decision and avoid any backtracking or hand the initiative over to the employee. Really important that, to make sure actually that you do the right thing from the beginning. They stop me doing what I want. You may have heard that HR on the employee side and not the employers. In many cases, HR has stopped employers breaching legislation, which could be a costly mistake. We at Pertorum here work with our clients to ensure that simple, pragmatic solutions are in place to ensure the employers are in control of their businesses and decisions. It's about a risk-based approach to the decisions that you want to make. HR, a gigantic waste of time. Why pay for HR when you can do it yourself? And actually, that's a proper question to ask, especially in a small business. But actually, look at your business as it grows. So actually, your HR risk, if not dealt with at the early stage and not in line with legislation, can bring additional costs. Certainly, finding things like tribunal claims and award, where some of these cases are uncapped. And are you growing a problem now for your future business? It's all about form filling and process. HR is bureaucratic, and do you know what? I want to make quick decisions. Decision making is always the business owner's prerogative, and actually HR can add value in that decision making process to make sure that the decisions are made with good judgment and, most importantly, supported by hard evidence if challenged. And it's recruitment, isn't it? Isn't HR recruitment? There's a lot of things that actually HR do, recruitment being one of them. So we hope by the end of the webinar, you'll realise actually it's far more than that. So I'm going to hand over to Adam now, who's actually going to talk about what HR actually does. So Adam, over to you.
Okay, thanks, Mark. So I think it's fair to say that HR is much, much more than recruitment, although recruitment is obviously a very important and significant aspect of the overall HR function. I think in our experience, the ways in which HR can add value to a small business will change and evolve as the business evolves and goes through its different elements of its life cycle. So whether as a small business you're starting up, maybe you're in a growth phase, or maybe you're approaching a period of change, the way in which HR adds value and the types of things that HR can do for you will be different. So for example, when you're starting up, the focus may well be on compliance. Actually, just really need to get set up to ensure that we've got the legalities of employment covered. We need to tick that box. We need to make sure that we've got people on proper, robust contracts of employment. We've got some decent policies in place. We're paying people properly. And that includes, of course, ensuring that all your obligations to HMRC are fulfilled, both in terms of PAYE and your pensions auto-enrolment obligations to the pensions regulator. So startup is probably going to be around getting some of that compliance type of infrastructure in place. As you grow, the emphasis and the complexities of your organization will start to evolve. That happens naturally as more people come into the business. And we'll look at growing organizations in a bit more detail on the next slide. But I think also for changing organizations, again, this is often where, you know, as HR specialists, we come into our own. And whilst we recognize that some people, you know, may be thinking, you know, as it says at the top of the slide there, well, every pound matters. So HR is an investment I don't need to make. I can do it myself. Or I've been managing so far without HR. That may well be very true. However, the risk of getting it wrong, particularly in a changing business, does mean that the stakes get much higher. And we can get into some of the more technical areas that are more difficult to research and implement yourself. So by change, what do we mean? It may be that the business needs to downsize or scale down. You know, that could result in some redundancies. Redundancies is a very technical aspect of change that has some statutory requirements around sharing information, consulting, and making payments in a certain way that comply with the legislation. It's fraught with, you know, the risk of getting it wrong, but it's also fraught with emotional challenge as well, you know, from employees in terms of the risk of them losing their job. So, you know, HR can really help, not only in terms of what you do and the process you follow, but how you do it and how you make people feel during that process. The change may be, a change in the nature of the business you're doing. Maybe you deliver contracts for other organizations. So if you're winning one of those contracts or perhaps losing one, this can sometimes be where TUPE, which is the Transfer of Undertakings Protection of Employment Regulations, come in. That would see a whole scale transfer of staff in or out of a business. You may be changing your physical location, moving to new premises. You might be taking on some new customers or bringing on new services or products into your portfolio. These could result in the need to perhaps change working hours, introduce new shifts, all of which have an impact on your workforce. And if not carefully thought through and not carefully handled, it can cause some issues in terms of implementation. And ultimately, the key thing is to make sure that your staff are focused on what's important. And for most of us running small businesses, that's on keeping our customers happy. In terms of supporting growing businesses, I think this really is where HR comes into its own. So if you were making an investment in technology, in machinery, in infrastructure, then you would have a plan about how you maximized your return on that investment, without doubt. You would recognize that you were spending an awful lot of money, and you would want to make sure you got the very best out of that technology or machine. For some reason, we don't always think in the same way about our people and our workforce. But actually, if we stop to think for a moment, the investment we make in staff is significant. You know, if the average person stays with us 5 or 10 years, you know, it's a simple calculation to work out the scale of that investment. And it can be an awful lot. So why do we treat the investment in our people any differently than we would the investment in a piece of physical kit? It's important to ensure that we set our teams up for success. And that really is where we specialize as HR professionals. Set people up for success so they understand your business, they understand what it is you're trying to achieve to be successful, and we align everyone in the business so that they're all pulling in the same direction with a common goal of driving business success. Ultimately, that's what we want. It sounds quite clinical. It sounds very planned and calculated. And to be quite honest, it is. You know, that is where, as an HR professional, we can really demonstrate our value. For sure, you know, people say, well, isn't HR about being nice to people? Well, no, it's not. But actually, if we flip a statement like that on its head, you know, if you're nice to somebody, and by nice, that's looking after their well-being. You know, you make sure that the well-being of your workforce is looked after. They're looked after physically, they're looked after mentally, and they're looked after financially. You're removing the barriers to somebody's engagement and loyalty and motivation to work for you. And once those things are in place, then there is a direct link to their productivity. So the method of having a structured, well thought out and fit for purpose HR plan or people plan or strategy really stacks up from a business perspective. Some of the specifics that might come within that may be about keeping an ongoing eye on compliance and therefore reducing HR risks. Hopefully you'll have got the business set up from day one with good contracts of employment, good policies, and good infrastructure in terms of pensions, payroll, and benefits. But as your business grows, are those core platforms scalable, and are they still working for your business today and in the future as they were when you set up? It's important to ensure that you don't end inadvertently in a situation whereby you perhaps have grown organically, you've just recruited people on individually negotiated contracts and packages as and when they join you. That might seem like the sensible thing to do, but after a while you may look back and realize actually you've created this tangled ball of string that's so complex to understand. It's so complex to administer when it goes through your payroll and administrative processes, and it can be quite complex, therefore, to unravel. At that point in time, far better to get your foundations in place that can grow with you as your organisation grows. That links it to your administrative processes. Keep things simple. Keep things fit for purpose and don't build complexity in from the outset, because the more people you have in your organisation, the more difficult that will be to do consistently well. When you're recruiting new staff, That's absolutely integral to business growth. Recruitment's only the start of it, really. You know, right people, right place, right time, and with the right skills and experience doesn't happen by accident. You need a plan, and you need to think how you're going to attract the very best people, not only to join your business, but also to stay with you for the long term. The risk of losing a new joiner in the first 3 months of their employment is significant. So that really should be a big red flag for anyone of us working in a small business. Have a great induction program and a great welcome experience for your new joiners. That mitigates the risk of them leaving significantly. We hear time and time again, so many people work so hard to find and recruit a new starter. The new starter arrives and the business isn't ready for them. There's nowhere for them to sit or work, or there's no computer, there's no uniform. Whatever it is they need to do their job hasn't been ordered in good time, so it's already on day one. That starts the relationship off on a bad note. Make the individual feel welcomed, make them feel valued, and help them to succeed from day one with your business, and think about that experience. Think about training, not just the training they need for today, but what training will they need for tomorrow? How do they want their own career to develop, and what personal development might they need to support them on that journey? As your business grows, are you taking on new clients, new services, and are there new requirements coming on board that mean people need to be trained in advance of that in order to ensure that there's still a really high class service being provided to your customers? Again, it needs a plan, it needs thought, and it needs structure. We touched on staff retention earlier. I think it's about giving people the compelling reason to stay with you. If people are happy, if people feel valued, and if people are comfortable, you know, from a job content and financial perspective, you know, most of us are more inclined to stay with what we know and where we're comfortable and where we've got good solid relationships rather than look elsewhere. So look after people and they'll look after you. But do think about, you know, performance, and do think about some of those challenging situations, you know, perhaps where people aren't performing. Don't ignore it. Nip it in the bud early. Be prepared to have direct conversations about setting your expectations and direct conversations with people about the consequences of not meeting those expectations. It's really important to tackle and address some of those things early. Also think about what you'll do if people are not well. Long-term sickness can be a huge issue for small businesses in particular. If you only employ four staff and one of them goes off on long-term sick, that's 25% of your workforce. That is a huge hit for any organisation of an SME size. So you need to be aware not only of the health and wellbeing issues for the employee, but also about the statutory and legal implications for you as an employer. What's the right thing to do to be fair to the employee, to be fair to you and your business, and think about those sorts of challenges, both from a legal and moral standpoint. The more people you've got in your workforce, the more likely those sorts of issues are to arise. So I think really within the context of HR support and what does HR do, the breadth and depth of support that HR can give is way, way beyond recruitment, as we said in the earlier slide. We really are a people service, and it's about, as we said earlier, making sure that you set your people up for success and making sure that your people are at the heart of your business success. So I'm now going to hand back over to Mark, who's going to bring us up to date with some changes to employment law throughout the remainder of this year.
Thank you, Adam, and some really good points there, especially with the Brexit backdrop now. Looking after and retaining people is going to be a key to business success, especially as the employment market potentially contracts as a result of our withdrawal from the EU. So I want to now just move on to the changes for the HR space around the legislation. So the first one I want to talk about is the employee's right to receive a written statement of terms. Currently, if you employ a new employee, you have 2 months to actually provide them with the written statement of terms. From the 6th of April, all employers will need to take action immediately to comply with this legislation. So therefore, you will need to provide the statement of terms for that individual from day one. So a real point to talk to your HR team, if you have one, or the person that looks after your statement of terms, to make sure that as part of your recruitment and induction process, that that new employee gets their statement of terms from day one. The second change is into the IR35, so the ongoing saga of IR35. So for those of you that are not familiar with IR35, it is the HMRC's drive to make sure that they look at any hidden employment and recover the appropriate tax and NI from employees. This has been going on in the public sector for quite some time and is now or should be rolled out to the private sector from the 6th of April 2020. And basically, this is the legislation that we would look at whether a contractor who works for you is actually an pseudo employee and therefore will need to be subject to tax and NI, so the off-payroll clients. Now, there is some provisos around whether somebody falls inside or outside of IR35 based on company size. So actually, if you're working for a company that has more than 50 employees, an annual turnover of 10.2 million, or a balance sheet worth over 5.1 million, then you will be subject to the IR35. This is something that the small businesses and the consultancy market have been challenging HMRC on for some time, because there is still a lot of defined detail to be worked through. Not only how HMRC are looking to administer, but the impact on the consultancy market itself. So if you are paying your tax and NI at source, then what does that mean on the impact of your VAT returns and your corporation tax? And there is a review currently underway to look at this fine detail, and we are eagerly awaiting the outcome of that review and whether actually the government and HMRC will look to delay the IR35 rollout until they've worked it through. So we do have a blog that we're updating on our website. So as and when we get updates, that will be something that you need to go to. So for those businesses that rely on specialist consultants coming in and you're over that criteria, something you need to be very mindful of, because you may need to bring them inside of IR35 and put them onto your payroll, or you need to then look at paying the tax and the NI to HMRC, and that your consultants might say they would want an increase to cover that additional cost, and therefore something to be factored in. Another one, which is which people think, well, why is the UK employment law talking about Sweden? This is the removal of Swedish derogation clauses from agency worker contracts. So actually, this is a part of the changes into the agency worker rights, which is a bit of a loophole that the government are looking to close. So this is where the Swedish derogation is actually also known as pay between assignments. So this is where a agency worker will give up the rights for pay parity to be able to be paid when they're not working on an assignment for an organisation. And this is certainly where you get some seasonal or manufacturing roles where actually you may have a piece of work that needs to be done and there may be a 2 to 3 week gap before something else comes on. There is about 130,000 agency workers tied up within this Swedish derogation activity, and the government have said, no, we're putting a stop to this because actually it's discouraging employers making the full-time commitment to employ them as employees. So for those of you that do use the agency workers under the agency worker rights and use Swedish derogation, you need to be mindful of that change. As Adam said in his part, you know, HR is about sometimes managing some of the more difficult parts of the employee journey, including settlement figures, redundancies, etc. So the changes that are coming into effect on the settlement payment is, at the moment, neither the employee nor employer national insurance contributions are payable on termination payments over the 30,000. From the 6th of April, actually, this is going to change, and actually the employer will need to pay the national insurance contributions at the 13.8% on those payments over 30,000. The employee piece actually remains exempt. So for those of you that are potentially going through any settlement payments, that needs to be factored in if actually that termination agreement or settlement agreement comes into effect after 6th of April. The next one is changes for reference period for holiday pay. So this is one that you need to be very mindful of. This is at the moment where if an employee takes holiday, their holiday pay for that period is calculated on their last 12 weeks of employment. And actually the average then goes into their average weekly earnings, which is then used to calculate their holiday pay. From the 6th of April, that 12-week period is going to increase to 52 weeks. So you need to look at that piece of legislation, not only from a cash flow perspective, so actually if you have people who have bonuses in certain parts of the year, potentially that bonus payment will now start to factor into holiday payments. So from a cash flow perspective, you know, if you are paying people through bonuses or some other payments related to salary, this potentially will come into the holiday pay calculation. So again, from a cash flow perspective, just need to make sure that that's factored in. Secondly, for those of you that have a payroll system that you're administering, you need to make sure actually that your payroll software reflects these changes, because actually you need to make sure that your system is calculating the holiday pay appropriately. Otherwise, it could lead to problems further on down the line. And if you have a payroll bureau, it is certainly worth asking the question that actually they have the legislation built into their processes and calculations. As with every tax year, there is some increases and decreases to statutory payments. And again, this year is no different. So, you know, we need to look at the HMRC site, and they have published payments increases for sick pay, maternity, share parental leave, etc. So making sure then, again, as with the previous point around holiday pay, that actually your payroll systems and all of your processes are reflecting those changes in those statutory pay rates. And Lastly, but not least, we go back to our old friend Brexit, obviously as part of our withdrawal from the European Union. We are looking as a country around the immigration, and recently the government has started to publish some of the detail that's around their points-based system for workers joining from the EU. So the immigration rules are coming into effect from January of next year. However, in the organisations who plan in advance may be looking at bringing people in prior to that date and actually bringing them across over the threshold of January when the new immigration rules take place. So this is very much a moving feast here, but we need to start to be looking at preparing ourselves for potentially costs around the visas and the additional immigration checks. The standard passport checks for right to work will not be valid from January of next year, so therefore that needs to be factored in. There is again, and we talked about it in our Brexit webinar previously, where you may find that you've brought somebody in before the end of the calendar year and you're asking them to work over that calendar year into the new financial year, and therefore you may need to be looking at sort of visa applications as a result of that that period of employment covering a cut over from our withdrawal from the EU when the new immigration rules come into effect from January. So just if we just put this on here, because actually from a small business perspective, you know, it's really important to keep up to date with changes to the way that workers are sourced. And again, the recent communication from government is the start of, I think, many more communications that are going to come out as the fine detail of Brexit is worked through. And again, our blogs and our previous webinars, we are keeping on top of this, so hopefully we'll be able to provide you with some information as and when it comes out from some central government. Okay, so that's the HR changes to legislation coming into effect from 2020. So I hope you've found this webinar useful, certainly around sort of dispelling some of the myths around how HR should work or does work, and as you can see the value, and also some of the legislation that is coming into force. So I'll hand over to Adam for any questions that we may have.
Okay, thank you, Mark. We've had two questions in so far. So the first one, Mark, is just back at you, really. Just this is from Chris to say, would you mind explaining the holiday pay changes again, please? So I think this is quite an important issue, particularly for small businesses, to make sure that actually we're paying people properly.
Yeah, and it's a good question. So the changes to holiday pay came about when there was a challenge into the employment court that says that actually these group of individuals, when they went on holiday, in effect took a pay cut because of their pay was made up of variable pay, such as overtime and on target earnings and bonus. And therefore the employment tribunals ruled that actually that should be taken into consideration when calculating holiday pay, and they set this 12-week rolling calculation. So at the moment, what happens is that your payroll teams will look back over your previous 12 weeks of employment and average out your pay for that week, and then multiply it by the amount of time that you are you're taking holiday. The changes now are really going to start to impact if actually you might find that you pay bonus at a certain particular part of the year. Say for instance you paid a winter bonus, and many people don't take holidays over the winter but actually look for the summer. Or in the rolling 12 weeks, if you're taking some holiday, those winter payments potentially wouldn't come into the calculation. However, with the new legislation, it will certainly will do, because actually it will be within that 52 weeks of the calculation.
Okay, thank you, Mark. And I think, as you said earlier, you know, making sure that your payroll system and your payroll processes are double checked would certainly be a very wise thing to do at the current time. So, Chris, I hope that's answered your question. Our contact details will be on the final slide, so please do get in touch if there's any further supplementary questions. The other question that we've got is probably one that I can answer, Mark, and it's, is a written statement of terms the same as a contract of employment? And I think the simple answer is no, but nearly. So a written statement of terms contains a list of very specific items that need to be included to comply with the legislation. The contract could be much broader than that. What most organisations will do is issue a contract of employment that contains all of the statutory requirements that are covered in the written statement of terms. So in other words, the written statement of terms is effectively subsumed into the contract of employment, and we simplify things by issuing one document rather than two. So there's a technical difference for sure. People do tend to use the two terms interchangeably, but there is a pragmatic and practical way of reducing the administrative burden and the potential complexity. The supplementary part of this question then is asking about employment policies, and particularly what employment policies are required as a startup business. So there are, in fact, only three policies, I would say, that are that as an employer you're legally required to have in place. They are a disciplinary procedure, a grievance procedure, and a health and safety policy. So they are essential to have in place. For startup businesses that may not want to or be ready to invest in the creation of discipline and grievance policies in particular, there are some free versions available on the ACAS website that set a very good standard for small businesses to follow, so they could be adopted. But certainly grievance, discipline and health and safety should be in place on day one. There are some others that we would recommend as being good practice for a startup. So we would always say an equal opportunities and diversity policy is important. Having an absence management policy is important. Being clear about your privacy policy, so your privacy statement and how you will process employee data is also, you know, critically important to comply with GDPR legislation. So there are some other aspects of broader legislation that also need to be considered here, but the ones that have to be referred to in your contract, discipline, grievance, and cover of health and safety as well. So that brings us to the end of the Q&As. We've not had any more submitted, so we'll take it that there are no more burning questions. It is probably timely just to let you know that we are planning to do a live Q&A session as a follow-up to this webinar in probably a couple of weeks' time. So we'll contact you and let you know the date and time of that for due course. And the reason that we're doing that is to give you perhaps a little bit of time to reflect on today's webinar, think about some of the issues that we've raised. And if you've then got some questions that you perhaps think of in hindsight, we can give you another opportunity to ask those. If there's anything particularly burning that you desperately would like to ask, contact details for both myself and Mark are on the screen now. And that brings us to the end of today's session. So I think all that remains is for both Mark and I to say thank you very much for joining us. We hope you found this morning's session useful and of value. We certainly enjoyed doing it, and we will be running many more of these sessions. So please do follow us on LinkedIn and any other social media platforms where we'll be keeping everyone up to date of what we're doing next. Thank you very much and goodbye. We hope you enjoy the rest of your day.